Welcome to Come to the Brink. I'm Zoe Flowers, and this is a space for those of us navigating profound life changes like loss, trauma, caregiving, and transformation. It's about what happens when everything you thought was solid crumbles beneath you and you're forced to rebuild. If you've ever felt like you're standing on the brink, this is the space for you. Welcome. A friend and I once performed a tandem storytelling called Body Talk about discovering the ancestral blessings of our kith and kin. Opalanga is an African-American griot, and she's very tall, like a yew tree, and as slender. I am Unamecana, and am built close to the ground, and am of extravagant body. In addition to being mocked for being tall as a child, she was told that the split between her front teeth was a sign of being a liar. I was told my body shape and size were the signs of being inferior and having no self-control. In this concurrent telling about body, we spoke of slings and arrows we received throughout our lives, because according to the great they, our bodies were too much of this and not enough of that. In our telling, we sang a mourning song for the bodies we were not allowed to enjoy. We rocked, we danced, we looked at each other. We were each thinking that the other is so mysterious, mysteriously looking in a beautiful way. How could anyone have thought otherwise? How amazed I was to hear that as an adult, she had journeyed to the Gambia in West Africa and found some of her ancestral people who, lo, had among their tribe many people who were very tall like the yew trees and as slender, and who had slits between their front teeth. This split, they explained to her, was called Sokaya Yala, meaning opening of God, and it was understood as a sign of wisdom. I love that. So
yes,
you know,
yes.
Every week, you know, I read from some sacred text, and we have been rocking with Women Who Run With The Wolves for at least 4 months now. She keeps showing up, and she is always completely in line with the guest. And so it is my pleasure to, first of all,
here's my gap.
Wait, you have a cat?
There it is.
Oh my God, I didn't even realize that. And you are tall as a yew tree.
Yes, I am.
Damn your people.
That's my people.
Wow.
My people all over the African continent.
So I am Zoe Flowers. Welcome, welcome back. Welcome to the brink. Okay. As you can see, I have somebody here who I've known for a very long time. I had the pleasure of being on her podcast a couple of months ago, and now she is with us today. And so we are going to take a deep dive into the unexpected places that grief can take us, the resilience we discover, and the courage it requires to reinvent our lives. My guest is the remarkable Elise Moore Orby, a dedicated leader in the domestic violence movement and who has spent decades advocating for transformational change. Reverend Elise Moore Orby and I worked together for many, many years at the Women of Color Network, and she's always been a pivotal leader against gender-based violence, blending her expertise with a dedication to justice and community empowerment. You know, I remember many times Elise would say, "We don't leave our people behind. We don't leave anybody behind as a community." And she truly understands social justice, especially in Black communities, emphasizing self-love and inclusive environments. By merging faith-based methods with modern activism, she advocates for systemic change, targeting the roots of violence and inequality. Utilizing Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality framework, Dr. Moore Orby enriches the discussion on gender-based violence, reflecting how race, gender, and class intersect to connect unique challenges. With 30 years in national and grassroots leadership, she excels in capacity building and collaboration. Her pastoral leadership demonstrates a commitment to transformative change, positioning her as a crucial advocate for those impacted by violence, fostering resilient communities for long-lasting progress and love. So with that, Welcome to the brain.
Thank you, thank you. That was so much.
I know. Well,
I was starting to feel old. I was starting to feel old, right?
No, you have to receive. It's just like, yes, I did that. I did all that. So, how are you arriving today?
Today has been such a wonderful day. It's so funny. One or 2 days a week, I have a problem with getting to sleep before 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, which then means that I wake up late in the morning. It's no such thing as late in the morning when you don't have a job, but still my mind says, oh, it's late. And so this morning I woke up late and I was thinking, oh, I got to get together. I got these things I got to do. And so I had two important things I had to do. Both of them were canceled.
That's been happening to me so much lately.
Yes, that is the thing. When I feel like, oh my God, I think when I try to put myself back in that old regiment that I used to be in, where just moving, 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 always got to do stuff, blah, 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 pressure, pressure. I think that's when spirit shows up and says, see, you did all of that for nothing. You got yourself all riled up for nothing. Because once again, everything was canceled and I was able to relax and do things that I wanted to do. So I am here today, feeling good. Da, na, 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 na. I knew that I would not. Yes. I am here. I'm feeling good and so glad to be on the podcast with you, Zoe.
Yeah, I'm super excited too. So, Elise also has a podcast, like I said, that I was on a couple of days ago, and we were talking about the movie Sinners and giving all of our opinions. As you said, you had three very opinionated ladies on the panel, and I was one of them. So,
Yes.
thank you for asking me.
Thank you for being available.
So I like to start gently at the beginning, so folks can, know a little bit about the person that we're talking to. So what was your early life like? What was young Elise like?
So funny because last night and this morning I was looking at some of my family line and remembering my ancestors, two, three generations back, and how either how wonderful they were because I knew them, or how wonderful they were because of the wonderful stories that I heard about them. Yeah. And so I was just kind of basking in that. This it's so funny. I called my daughter, was like, let me tell you this, let me tell you this, baby. And she was like, mommy, mommy. None of those names mean anything to me. I'm like, yes, it was 100 years before you were born, but it's the same people I've been talking about.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, so my life, I think, it probably is very normal for a Black woman growing up, especially in Los Angeles in the 60s, 70s. So my parents, both my parents, my father was from Alexandria, Louisiana. His family migrated in the 50s to Los Angeles, and my mother was from Shreveport, Louisiana. Not quite sure when my mother's family migrated, but my mother's family was a very small family. I just knew my grandmother and my great grandmother. But my father's family, most of my life I live with my aunt, and that's a whole nother story. I live with my aunt, and so I was always around my aunts, my great aunts, Big Nana, Little Amos,
Wait,
all the
what?
ain't miss.
Oh, Amos, okay.
Ain't miss. So all those nicknames for aunts and grand aunts. And so I grew up with them and their families. And we used to it's so funny, they used to call it a club. They used to call a family a club because they paid dues and they had these big parties every year, twice a year actually.
Got it.
Yeah. And then I think every other year they would have the reunion. So I grew up around all this wonderful blackness in my extended family. And also growing up in South, what they now call South Central Los Angeles, growing up in a very black neighborhood, middle class black folks, most folk work for like the car industry or the aerodynamics, school district, et cetera, post office, those folks. So all of them homeowners, several kids, living life wonderfully. For their most of them were like first generations born in Los Angeles, or they came when they were 5, 6 years old, so it was the only home they knew. And so surrounded also by businesses, all the grocery store, the cleaners, the tire, the gas station, the restaurant, everything around you was black owned. And it was just a wonderful, it's a wonderful place. It's the most wonderful. To this day, it's still the most, well, I love Oakland, but
You do. Yeah.
historically, it's just a wonderful place. So I grew up where blackety black was the thing, where people love being black. And it, of course, we had our own internal stuff too, colorism and all that stuff that we learned through racism and all that stuff. But for the most part, it was a very loving community. It really was that community they talk about where Miss Taylor, if Miss Taylor see you acting up, Miss Taylor coming down her off her porch and spanking your butt all the way home. It was really one of those communities. So yeah, so my childhood, in the sense of growing up in community, I think that's where I developed, I don't think, that's where I developed my love for Black community and just for Black family, for Blackness. Yeah, and so I still hold on to my, I remember a professor when I was in grad school said to me, he said, Elise, you're so nostalgic about Black people and Black community. I was like, yeah, and I'm not going to let anybody take that from me. With all of our stuff, I still just see us as perfect, wonderful, brilliant, beautiful people. And so, yeah, so that was the blessing of my childhood.
So you had all black teachers and all that.
Yes, well, not all black, not all black. This it was the 60s, so.
All right. But the majority for sure. And so you grew up in LA, and when I met you, you were in the South. So what was happening in between that
Yeah, so
migration?
because my people were from the South, once again, I was infatuated with the South. And so because I had all these wonderful stories about great aunts and great uncles, growing up like siblings, and though they were first cousins, they didn't know who was the married auntie and who was the actual uncle. Everybody was just family, and so all these beautiful stories just about community and family. And so I wanted to see and be a part of that. And so people used to tell me all the time, Elise, you're not going to see the South that we grew up in. You're not going to see that. That's number one. And you have to remember that we're telling the story. Everyone's telling the story that they want to remember.
So when you got there.
So yeah, so I chose Durham, North Carolina. I chose North Carolina because it was the South, but not deep South, had a little bit of Eastern culture influence. And so we got a little bit of theater and music and art and science and research. We had some of all of that going on in North Carolina. And when you were in the city, like Durham or Charlotte, or the capital, you really got a different type of urban vibe. You wouldn't know you were in one of them in a red state where KKK was everywhere. You wouldn't know it when you're in the city. And so when I went to Durham to visit, to look, I was looking for places to stay, and I looked in Washington, D.C., and a couple other places. I fell in love with Durham the moment my foot hit the tarmac.
Wow.
It felt like Oakland to me. It felt like Oakland.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, and at that time, my girlfriend, who would later become my wife, her family lived in Virginia.
Okay.
And she wanted to be close enough. Her mother was in her 70s at that time. She wanted to be close enough to drive to her mother's,
Got it.
but not close enough where
Got
she
it.
expected to. So Durham, North Carolina turned out to be a perfect fit. And then my wife's oldest daughter had gone to school in New Orleans and settled in, got married and started having kids and got her PhD and all that stuff. So her life was in New Orleans, and so it really turned out to be a good location.
Wow.
I went to Louisiana several times and spent like up to a week at a time with some of the ancestors that were still around, and l got lots of stories and got a chance to see some of the areas where my father and his siblings, my aunts and uncles, grew up. I got a chance actually to see the house that my father was born in. And so yeah, so it just kind of solidified, concretized some of my imaginations. And it was good. It was good. It was good. I still love the South, even after living there. I still love the South.
So how did you become Reverend Dr. Elise Moore Orby? Were you always drawn to the world of spirit? Like, how did that happen?
So I'm going to try to weave in a little bit of the spiritual part and the practical part. So even though I grew up in a Black community, and I grew up in my aunt's home. My mother and father were in separate and different places. My aunt, who was a domestic, she went to church. She was on the usher board and all of that. But she didn't make us go to church, and so I didn't grow up in church. My mother didn't go to church at all when I was a little kid. My grandmother on my mother's side did. Whenever I would spend the weekend or summers with her, we got up every morning and caught the bus to church, and then from church we went downtown to have lunch and catch a movie, mostly Elvis Presley, but a
Wow, church every
couple
day,
of yeah.
every morning.
And so I really didn't grow up. I really didn't grow up in church. But my grandmother, my father's mother, who had lived with my aunt, the house I was raised in for several years until she passed. She had one of those white pictures of Jesus in the room. But more importantly, she started a church, found a pastor, got the people together. She was really the leader, the informal leader of that congregation. She was a prayer warrior. And so I grew up with those stories. Now, so she died. When she died, I was 6 or 7.
Oh, okay.
So I only really remember her being in wheelchair and in the bed, but I remember her. I remember she was in a hospital bed, and so I used to hide under her bed. I used to hide under her bed. I remember hearing her sing and pray, praying. I remember I, you know, I realized in retrospect that that was the pain and suffering that she was going through, and that was her way of making it through it.
The singing.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the scene in Sinners when Delta Slim is remembering what happened to his homeboy.
Oh,
And
yes.
then he just
He breaks
starts,
out in song. Yes.
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I was really little when my grandmother died, but once again, nothing but stories
Yeah.
from the whole community and even outside of our immediate community, the church community, about who she was. And so what I knew is that she had this deep love and trust for somebody named Jesus. I knew that for most of my life. And as I got older, I wanted to know what my grandmother knew. And that's the best that I can explain that. I could tell that my grandmother was connected in some kind of spiritual way, of which I saw no one else emulate in my family. She had something going on, and I wanted to know what that was. And so, as a young kid, I was always very interested in spirituality. I was interested mostly in Egyptian spirituality and cosmology, and I was always way out there trying to discover the unknown and trying to connect with that which I couldn't see and touch, but was very powerful. And so it was many years before I was an adult, before I made the connection with Jesus.
I see.
And I made the mistake of going to church a few Sundays and hearing people preach and teach. Well, it's more of a teaching ministry. Teach about this. And I was like, I like this guy. I like this guy. I mean, I literally began to fall in love with this. And I was like, I want to be like him. I want to have this connection when he says, you know, when you see me, you see God. I was like, I want to know how is that? I want to be that. I want to be able to be in the world, but not of the world. I want to be like that. I want to put my community first and teach them how to love and care for each other and resist the powers that be. All of that just made sense to me. I was like, yes, this is my guy. This is who I want to be with and be like. And so I started on that journey of really, I started on a journey of just reading everything I could about Jesus. One day, I really sensed that the Spirit was telling me that I was supposed to teach, that what I was learning, I should be teaching. And I was like, whoa, okay. So that was the beginning of that. I decided to quit my day job that I'd been in about 10 years at that point. I had a job working with the union, Lucky's Union, in the transportation department, so I could work midnight. And so I went to school, went to Bible college, went to school during the day. While when I got ready to, when I was graduating from my undergrad, the dean of the college came to me. I wrote a paper on missions that had to do something with Christianity and mission and Christianity and Islam, and the bridging of those two to heal the Black community. And so the dean came to me and he said, you know, you need to go to seminary. And I was like, seminary, I didn't even know what that is. So I had to research that, first of all. He said, you just have too many questions and you have too much passion around the healing of your community. This is a white guy, the healing of your community. You need to get equipped. That was his word. You need to get equipped to do that ministry. And so I was thinking, in my mind, I was thinking, and what do you mean I need to be equipped?
And this wasn't a religious College?
Yes. This
Oh,
was a
okay.
very, this was a Christian
I
college.
see.
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. Okay. So this makes sense. Okay.
And so, I really thought, love and truth and compassion, I thought those were the only tools you need for doing the work in the community that I
Right.
thought needed to be done. And so, so he said, so let's do this. He says, why don't you just apply to Fuller Theological Seminary and see if you get in, and we'll take it from there. So I was like, okay, and I was like, graduate school. So I applied, I got in, I met the most magnificent Black theologians in all of the world there, though they weren't professors there, they were always coming in, teaching a class and moving on, or coming in to do lectures. We had one Black professor, two, one Black professor in missionology, none in theology, and then one in psychology. But that's a whole nother story, because then
Yeah.
we start talking about how I got involved in social justice work.
Yeah, well, we'll get there.
So I ended up going to seminary and discovered Black theology and Jacqueline Grant's White Woman's Christ and Black Woman's Jesus. And so a whole Black Christology that I'd never known. And so this, the Jesus of the liberated people that comes out of South American theology, and African theology. And it just made me fall in love more so with Jesus. And the real, what I came to believe was the real liberation platform for liberation for Black community. And I had no intention of pastoring. Again, I thought I was going to be doing, I thought I was going to finish my master's of theology, and then I was going to do either an MPH or an MPA. I want to do something around community development and community healing work. And so, that's where I thought I was going, the direction I was going. And my, once again, the last semester of my graduate program, one of the interim professors came and said, who was pastoring a church in Fremont, which is where my house was at, because I left the Bay Area and moved back to Los Angeles to go to Fuller Theological Seminary. And he said, I've been working with him, doing some work around recruiting Black students and Black professors. And so, anyway, he came to me in the last semester and said, I would really love for you to be the associate pastor at my church in Fremont.
Wow.
And I thought, pastoring, that was not, that's not on my agenda.
Yeah.
And so I played around with that for I think about a year,
Yeah.
and finally took it on when I realized, after spending attending the church for about a year, and I realized, so it was mostly middle class, upper middle class Black folk, most of them HBCU graduates, most of them in the dot-com world, and kids were in private school and all that. And I thought, this is the nucleus I need to do the healing work in Oakland. These are my people. They've got the influence and the money, the resources to do the work that we need to do in Oakland. And so in Africa. So anyway, so I signed up and said, okay, so I'll be the associate pastor. And I really focused on missions and community development work. And so did a lot of work in Oakland and Oakland School District. With Oakland, Alameda County shelter, homeless shelter, and lots of community-based program,
Yeah.
based programs, and then did some work in South Africa as well. And so yeah, so I it wasn't some magical, mystical moment or
Yeah.
anything like that. It was really an evolution. And I think if anything, it was just my passion still today I just want to be like Jesus.
Oh. So while you're doing all of those things and you're working in our community, I'm wondering about grief in those moments. Like, what were there experiences of grief that you were carrying? Would you have recognized it as grief at that time? Were you seeing it mirrored in the community, in our community? What was your relationship to grief then?
So I think my grief, I was introduced to grief very early. I think at 6, 7 years old when my mother and father separated. And my father, I don't know, my father was so broken. He never recovered from his mother being sick and suffering so long and dying. He never could reconcile that with the woman of faith. He always said that there can't he two things he always said, there can't be a God because one, I went to Korea and I watched a bunch of white folk make black and brown folk kill other black and brown folk. So there can't be a God. That was his first point. And the second point was, can't be a God because my mother loved Jesus more than anybody, and he allowed her to suffer for years and then die. And from the day she died, everything changed for him, therefore changed for me. I lost my best friend, and my father was my best friend. I just see that my battery is getting low. Can I get my charger? I should have been pre
A
better prepared.
pause. It's fine.
So yeah, I lost my father at about 6, 7 years old. He just went on a painful journey of losing. He lost hope. He just lost hope. He tried several things. He joined the Black Muslims and hung up with Malcolm and did some of everything to try to drugs, everything to try to find his way, but he did not. So as a little girl, they call my daddy Buddy Red, and they used to call me Buddy Red's girl. That's I didn't have a name. I just we went everywhere he went, I went.
Like me and my
He
dad.
really was like a best friend. So I think my first experience with grief was really the loss of my father, and my best friend. And I think that grief stayed with me probably to my late 30s before I actually acknowledged it and began to work with it. Try to figure out what is this? What is this? This got me in this little box. This that's stifling the way I live my life. This limiting the way I live my life. That is also controlling my emotions. And well, hold on, I think so. Anyway, so yeah, so I think that was my first introduction to grief. I think my I'm about to say something I've never said, I don't think, to anyone. I think my next experience with grief, when I was 13 or 14, somewhere between those two, I was raped by my best friend's cousin and conceived a baby from that. And in my immediate family, my mother n nor my auntie never talked about sex or anything. Your body, nothing. This is your menstrual cycle, nothing. I got no tips, no learning, no nothing. Nothing. And so when my mother discovered that I was pregnant, because I didn't know I was pregnant, she made an appointment for me to, well, first I got talked about, right, as if I had known what happened.
You didn't even know what you didn't even know what
No,
happened.
I didn't
And
know
you
what
didn't
happened.
even know you were pregnant.
Right. I didn't know what happened. I didn't know that that was rape. I didn't know. I knew that it was something about sex, but I knew nothing about sex. So it was even, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so my mom made an appointment for me to go down and get an abortion. And I think that the grief that I experienced there, not I think, I know, the grief that I experienced in that time was the, I want to say the loss of my voice. But even now, as I'm preparing, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, shit, Lisa, you never had a voice. You never had a voice. Maybe what you realize at that point is that you didn't have a voice. Nobody asked you anything. They only told you, right down to getting an abortion, and knew very little about what that even meant. The only thing I knew was what the nurse told me before I went in for the abortion. Not that I could comprehend all of that either. And so there's a whole loss in that experience, and it's probably more complicated than I know. And so, like I'm talking about it for the first time ever. But I've always felt a loss there. And it's never been like, oh, I lost a baby.
No.
It was
Yes, and
something much larger. I lost something much larger in that experience.
Yes.
And regretted, angry, all kind of feelings about that. So I think that was my next experience with grief. And as you can see, I don't think I've not done anything with that.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I like to get woo-woo, and thank you for sharing. And it's not like lost on me that we're having this conversation on a Friday, which is Venus Day, which is all about love, which is what you talk about all the time, and self-love. And so, yeah, maybe it's time to like. We also have Gemini and Cancer, and I mean Jupiter and Cancer, and Jupiter expands everything it touches, and Cancer is about the home. And so maybe it's like time to again excavate and excavate that and put it out on the Gemini wind.
Think that I don't think that I've consciously carried it, or that it has influenced, I don't think, any of my decision making or feelings about my mom, because I have enough feelings about my mom without that. That would only be like a cherry on top of everything else. But I also haven't delved into it to see what the little girl was feeling and thinking, experiencing, and what she lost.
Yeah.
And I'm not in this moment, I think I don't want to know. What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, but now that I've said it out loud, I know some shit gonna go down now.
Maybe, maybe not.
I'll probably be writing all the rest of the night.
Damn, Zoe.
Yeah.
So,
So,
yeah, go ahead.
yeah, so I think that was my second experience with grief.
Yeah.
And then of course, I think my most yeah. Unexpected experience with grief was when I had my stroke. And I had just gotten to a place in life where I liked me for the first time in life. I liked me. I was proud of me. I was good with me. I was doing my life. I was with the woman of my dreams. My daughter was brilliant and beautiful and everything. We're living in North Carolina, and I was teaching at Duke School of Theology in the summertime and working with women of color, doing the work around domestic violence and child exposure. I was and I was rooted in my spirit, even though my theology was starting to evolve at that point. I was starting to question a whole lot of things. I still felt so good, so confident. I like me so I'm damn, I like me. I like me. Ooh, I never like me like I like me. And I had that stroke. It seemed as though for a good year that I lost me. I lost the me that I first of all took all those years for me to come to know and like. And I felt like I lost the most important parts of my brain, I thought. I thought, ooh. So, first of all, I had, my cognitive processes went kapooey. First thing that happened is I couldn't talk. I couldn't talk for days. And I had to go to speech therapy and all that stuff. And I thought, wait a minute, this is my life. My life is thinking and talking. How can I lose my ability to think and talk? Not, oh man, I just felt like I lost who I was. That what I relied on is my brain's ability to look and analyze and understand things in different ways and perspectives, and to be able to be in a room full of people and to have different conversations and hold those different points at the same time and talk to and about them. And whew, and I was like, I've lost what makes me me. That's what I thought. And so for a full year, I was, ooh, so depressed. For a while, I was so depressed, I didn't know I was depressed. And so my wife finally said to me one day, "Are you finished?" Like, with what? He said, "Are you finished feeling sorry for yourself?" So she was like, "If you're finished, then let's find a therapist, somebody you can talk to." So yeah, I think that and even For a while, I'm not gonna lie, for a while, the therapy made it worse,
Yeah.
because they make you on earth shit.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
it just got me to a place where I could move forward, but I still wasn't whole. I was still angry as I don't know what. Ooh, I was so angry. Ooh, I was angry. I was already at a place where I was unpacking my current theology and throwing out shit. This doesn't work anymore. This doesn't mean what it, blah, blah. And then the stroke, and I was like, oh, just let's throw out the baby in the bathwater. Let's just let's throw all of that out. And so I was, so I was angry. I was in this evolution. What I didn't realize then was an evolution of my theology. Then it just seemed like more loss. It seemed like I'm losing my faith. That lost me. And losing my faith, as I began to talk more about that, there was more division between me and the church, the denomination I was with at that time. And they were like, we don't think so, Elise.
You know, you just said domination and not
So, same thing,
denomination.
denomination.
That's so interesting.
Can be used interchangeably.
Okay. Noted.
And so I had to let them go too. And so I was like, my brain was gone, my ability to speak well was gone, my faith as it was gone. Now my church home on a national level was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt like an orphan. I've literally, and that's why I tell people, I feel like an orphan. I feel like I have no home. I have no nothing. I have no grounding. I have no home. I have nothing. Which it took me a long time to realize you had the most magnificent woman in the world and the best daughter in the world. How in the world could you think you had nothing? But it took me a long time. And it was actually, I don't remember what Porvi said to me, but Porvi said something to me that had me thinking that I had to that I had to accept whatever limitations I think I had from the experience so that I could prove that it wasn't true.
Oh, that sounds like Porvy. Hey, Porvy. Shout out to Porvy Shaw. We love you very much. I like to think of grief now as a portal that just takes us from one place to another. And so, if grief is a portal, what do you think it connected you to on the other side? Or, yeah, of that experience?
So we should have started this podcast with that because as a result of losing who I was,
Yeah.
I became this magnificent person I am now.
Come on.
And I don't just like me, I love me. I love me some me. And I began to love myself. Well, I began to like myself again. And then, with the loss of my wife, in my attempt to journey through that grief, I began to fall in love with myself.
Did you create a grief practice consciously, or did you stumble into something and you were like, ooh, this feels good?
No, I guess, yes. So I remember, so the losing of myself, yes, I began to do very specific things to talk to myself and to tell myself all the right things about my brain, about my future, about who I am. I had to change my belief system about who I was. And so that was a process and a practice. Had to read a whole lot of stuff, had to participate in a lot of stuff to get to a place where I could see that I was so much more than what I thought I was. And who I am, I can never lose that. And so that was very intentional practices and things that I went through. When my wife died, I'm not gonna lie. No, I just wanted to die too. I didn't want to. It was too painful. It's too. It's just too painful. And so, that whole first year, my friend Cindy, who was on my podcast week before last, she told me she had lost her husband too several years back. And she told me, she said, I'm not going to let you go through, she's an MSW. I'm not going to let you go through what I went through, which is whatever your journey is, you won't go through it alone. And I mean, she stuck with me like glue. And so she allowed me to be in denial. She allowed me to be angry. She allowed me to be sad. Wherever I was, she met me right there. And so I survived that first year because I was trying to, I was hoping that I would have a stroke and just go. And so then year two comes and I'm like, now I've been so terrible to my body that first year, I'm really miserable. So I'm not only miserable emotionally, psychologically, I'm miserable physically. And so then a friend of mine, not a friend, but a colleague of mine says, the beginning of transformation is first deciding that you don't want what you have anymore. You're tired of what you got. And I was like, whoo, I'm tired of being sick and miserable and I'm tired, whatever this is, I don't want to be this anymore. I don't want to live like this. If this is life, I don't want to live like this. I don't want to live in this deep grief. I don't want my body to be like this. I don't want this life. And that's when I went looking for, well, in my mind, I went looking for, but oddly enough, on that same podcast, I was introduced to somebody who ended up being my coach. All that to say that the portal that was open for me, of course, was the portal of love. My coach said to me so many things, but one of the critical things that she asked me was, she asked me, she said, how did you know that Tanya loved you? I had to write that for days. And so when we got met for our next session, she said, how can you treat yourself the way that Tanya treated you? How can you do those same things? How can you experience those same things? How can you be that to yourself? And that was the beginning of me falling in love with myself. I didn't know that I could. I didn't know anything about self-love. And where I come from, it's about taking care of yourself. It's about self-care. You take care of yourself. You make sure you get you a good job, get your education, so you take care of yourself. That's the love that I received, and that's the only love that I knew. It wasn't about some deep knowing and emotional and psychological connection with another human being or yourself. It was just about taking care of yourself. And
What do you,
so,
well, I just want to ask you, what do you think that mindset does to Black women? That doctrine.
yeah, I think it does a couple things. I think the worst thing, and probably the most important thing, I think that it does, is first of all, then it deprives women of ever knowing what it is to love themselves. That's the first thing, and you haven't lived until you love yourself. Until you know love with your entire being, you haven't lived. You've been cheated out of life, And so that's the first thing. It robs them of a full life, the life that we are really meant to live. That's number one. And then number two, I think, is what happens is we. Since we don't know that love, and all we know is self-care, is then we're duped into thinking that self-care is self-love. And that might not be so bad if we weren't Black women. But because we're Black women who's hated by most of society and is never seen as beautiful, desired, wanted, blah, 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 brilliant, all those things, then taking care of ourselves becomes a method, a practice of doing things to appear to the rest of the world that we are worthy of all those things, that we are all those things, that we are beautiful, that we are brilliant. So we live a life of trying to prove to other people our value and worth. Again, a life missed.
Yeah, I've been talking about like the things that have happened in the course of my life and the things that happened, like caretaking for my mom is little terrors. It's just like little terrors. Minute after minute after minute, trying to do what you just said is a life of terror, even if we look good doing it.
And it's so hard to come against because, again, it's all the rest of the world that is saying, you need to be like this, or if you do all these things, you'll be on the track of proving to us that you are worthy, that you are lovable. And so, the whole world is again issue. And then you just got this small little group of Black women who've been fortunate to discover or have experienced love. Ooh, God bless the women who grew up in houses where they were loved from day one and knew nothing but love. And so they grew up loving themselves. That was taught to them very early on to learn how to embrace and love themselves. There's such a blessed little group, minority. But it's just a few of us, who are trying to come against that knowing and living way of living. And our voices, I think, are drowned out again by the larger world that's saying, oh no, you got to focus on this. And of course, that's monetized. What they tell you got to do in order to prove value and worth is monetized. So you need to do your hair, skin, body, perfume, where you shop, what clothes you wear, where you live. All the things that you got to do to say that you're valuable costs money. The whole beautification trip costs money. The whole I've arrived, I'm middle class or whatever it is. I'm educated or whatever the thing is, it costs money. It costs money to prove to the world that you're valued, that you have value. And that you're worthy of love. And so as a result, we end up living a life where we never have known what it is to know love and to be loved, to love ourselves. We're robbed of the best gift that we've been given. And we spend our life chasing a capitalistic view of who we are. And one day you close your eyes with that shit.
Interesting. Do you feel like that is, because I feel like the younger generation of women that I see to a certain extent are shaking off a lot of expectations, but I think social media and capitalism and all of those things is still very much presentation, presentation, presentation. But do you think you're seeing that lesson, or you think it's the same?
I have to be careful because you know I have a 27 year old.
Okay.
So just to be clear, Lethe, I'm not talking about you. So I would say no. I'd say that they've been hoodwinked by a new version of distraction from knowing and loving yourself. So they've got all this new language and ways of expressing their identity and all that stuff. All I think they're caught up, they're just caught up in a different distraction that still doesn't focus on knowing, loving yourself. Just because just because they're saying, oh, I'm not going to work 40 hours a week, and that doesn't say you're loving yourself because you feel like you're not going to participate in the capitalistic, whatever it is. That is not one and the same.
So what have you learned about loving yourself? Like, what does it look like?
I have to say the first is a feeling that literally I feel in my body all the time. I feel alive. My body feels alive. I feel like I am something more than I've ever been before. I feel like this energy in my body. I feel like I can do anything. I can be anything. I feel like there are just all the unlimited possibilities are there for me. And I can reach out and try, test any of them. I have unlimited potential. I think that's the first thing. And probably I have to, go to my old faithful, which is I believe that self I so I believe love is this, is to be seen, to be valued, to be respected, and be desired. That's to me, that's what love is. And so whether I'm asking that of somebody else or myself, or I'm giving that to somebody else, it's always those same things. I see me. Woo! Girl. I see me and I love me when I see me. I value me when I see me, I'm like, you are the shiggity bomb. I mean, that's
Love
just,
it.
yeah. I mean, just all of that. And so, and I value and respect what I do, whether I decided I was going to learn how to play guitar.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You sure did.
And so, learn how to read music and play the guitar, two totally different things that I thought this brain that's been traumatized by strokes 3 times now could not do. And yet I am. Am I doing it perfectly? Hell no. Can I go on stage or entertain anyone? No.
Not
But
yet.
every time I sit down with my music book and my guitar, I play the notes just as they're supposed to be played. And I'm reading the notes. I'm like, every time, I'm amazed at myself every time. I'm like, shit, you couldn't do this 6 months ago. 6 months ago, you couldn't read music. You couldn't even pluck the, I know the strings, the notes on the guitar. I didn't know that before.
Wow.
And so I'm like, I'm amazed with myself. I love and I'm grateful and excited that I'm doing what I want to do. I'm not doing what I have to do.
You're doing what
That's
you want to do.
gone. I'm doing what I want to do. Now I realize, and I say this in my book, letting go of things that are bad for you but feel really good to you. I realize that I may be at a privileged place in my life at 67 that I can say I do what I want to do. But I want to believe that we can make that choice anywhere in life, at any time in life. The challenges may be different, the sacrifices may be different, but at any point in life that we decide, I'm not going to play this game anymore,
Period.
yes, we can make that choice.
Period. We have a choice. We have choices.
Yes. Yes.
We have choices.
So yeah,
So,
so for people who have loved, for my sisters who've really loved other people, I'm like, hey, take that and say, how can I do that for myself? How can I feel that way about myself? How can I act that way about myself? So when the person you like, love, care about, whatever walks in the door, and you're like, damn. How about when you look in the mirror and you say, damn, how can you, what, how, what can you get there? The same way you prioritize your partner, can you prioritize yourself? Can you focus on you like you focus on them? Can you like, when they do something wrong, you're always like, oh, it ain't no big thing, ain't no problem, I'll write that up. Same thing for you. Can you get to a place where when you make a so-called mistake, you can let that slide? You can like, girl, I'm not gonna hold that against you. You all right, let's move on. It's the simple, we know as Black women, we know how to love others. And I'm just saying, turn that mirror around and practice that with yourself.
Yes, Ashe.
And that's for me, that's what the portal of grief, that's where it took me. It took me to falling in love with myself.
Wow. So in this beautiful life that you're continuously co-creating, how can people support you? How can people show you love? Like, do you have social media that they can follow you? Books I heard you talk about. Like, how can people show you love?
Yes. Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. So the first way people, my sisters, can show me love is if they start practicing self-love, if they start a journey. That's what I want more than any, that's, I think, is my purpose. I'm here for love. I'm here. I was here. I had to first learn it and get it myself. And that's been my journey. And now my purpose is to evangelize, so to speak, to show people how that can really be materialized. And so I would love nothing more than, sisters that hit me up on Black Women Talking Back, social medias, all the social medias, and say, hey, I hear you. I want to start trying. I want to begin to unpack. Whatever it is, I want to start the journey. I don't know where I'm going to start, but I'm going to start the journey. Or I'm doing these things. I turned that corner last year, and this is where I am now. So to hear from sisters that they are starting a journey or beginning a journey or on the journey of loving themselves more, nothing would bring me more joy than that.
Thank you. And what else are you working on besides Black Women Talking Back podcast? And when does it air? What time?
So, Black Women Podcast, we just recorded our fourth podcast, which is the Sinners podcast, and we're looking at the women in the movie Sinners. And so that should be on all of our platforms, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and something else I'm forgetting. You'll be able to see those next week. You'll also be able to see that we did a the week before we did a recording on self-love and self-care. So where we really delve into that conversation. So absolutely, you can see that on our podcast. Love to hear feedback, your thoughts on the self-love, self-care podcast. That would be great. And probably so I'm in next week I'm also sending the manuscript off to my editor for letting go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's done.
Yes.
You've been
Well,
busy.
I think it's done.
And I mean, when I say done, I mean,
We'll
yeah,
see what the editor says.
that's right. That's right. That's phenomenal. Yeah, you've been busy.
Yes, I'm doing the things that I really want to do, which is I wanted to sit down and talk with Black women. I've been wanting to do that most of my life. And now I wrote the book. I started out writing the book really to answer a question my sister asked me about myself. And as I reflected on that question, the next thing I knew was f 5 pages later, and I knew that there are aspects of the story of my life that I needed to tell as a gift to my sisters. And so that's what the Letting Go book really is. It is, it's first of all, it's first of all because I love myself. That's why I did it. That's the main reason I did it. I love myself because I now know that I can do all the things that I've ever wanted to do. I don't have any limitations. So I wrote the book. But I also wrote it as a gift for my sister.
Got it. Got it. So, I like to always end with what's one thing you're grieving and what's one thing you're grateful for?
So it's the same side of the same coin, a different side of the same coin. So I think the only thing that I really grieve at this point in my life are the days that I wake up and I have some aches somewhere in my body. But the only reason I grieve those days is because those other days I woke up and I felt like $1 million. My body felt, hey, what you want to do? We can do it all. What you want to do? You want to dance and then go walk 2 miles? We're going to do that today. We got it. So it's only because of those wonderful days that those other few days when my body says, whoo, can we just lay here? Can you just take me to the sauna? Can we just sit in the hot water? Yeah. So it's two sides of the other same coin. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Elise. This has been such a great conversation.
Thank you,
And
Carolyn.
I know it's going to touch people. And I just want to invite people to DM me to share your stories, to let me know what you thought about this conversation. And again, you can follow Black Women Talking Back, where all podcasts are available. And I just want to thank you all for listening. And don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to Come to the Brink with Zoe Flowers. Episodes drop every Tuesday, 7:11 Eastern Standard Time, AM, with bonus episodes dropping when I feel like it. And yeah, I'll see you soon. And don't forget to reach out because nobody should be on the brink alone. I am Zoe Flowers, and I will see you soon. Bye.